Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, contributing authors Luis Alberto Urrea, Juan Martinez, Joe Mino, and Jack Gems discuss their work in the collection Small Odysseys. Selected Shorts presents 35 new short stories. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
My name is Sonal Shukla. Thank you so much for coming in today. I am the Assistant Director of Programming and Education at the American Writers Museum. Welcome to the American Writers Festival and to this event. In our next program, readers will encounter long-ago movie stars, a town full of dandelions, and math lessons from Siri. They will attend karaoke night, hear a 20-something slacker's breathless report of his failed recruiting by the FBI, and travel with a father and son as they channel grief into running a neighborhood bakery truck. They will watch the Greek goddess Persephone encounter the end of the world and witness another apocalypse through a series of advertisements for a touchless bidet. And finally, they will meet an aging loner who finds courage and resilience hidden in the most unexpected of places, the next generation. The Tales in Small Odysseys, a new collection of short stories from prominent authors as well as up-and-coming superstars, are published in partnership with beloved literary radio program and live show Selected Shorts in honor of its 35th anniversary. Here to discuss their stories are Pulitzer Prize finalist Luis Alberto Urrea, author of The Devil's Highway, The Hummingbird's Daughter, Into the Beautiful North, Queen of America, and most recently, The House of Broken Angels. Juan Martinez, author of short story collection Best Worst American, winner of the Newcomb Institute Literary Award, Literary Arts Award. Novelist and short story writer and teacher Jack Gems, author of Total Work of Art, The Grip of It, and My Only Wife. Joe Menno, author of 7 novels and several short story collections. Please put your hands together for them.
Okay, so hi, welcome everyone. I'm curious, just to start out, if there are people who have been to a Selected Short show, or if you've listened to the podcast, yeah? A couple people? So if you're unaware, the program is, it's actors, really good actors, reading hand-selected stories, sometimes commissioned stories, selected by Selected Shorts. the origin of Selected Shorts, so it's 35 years old, and the anthology that we're here to celebrate today is representative of that. It's 35 new stories commissioned by the organization Selected Shorts. The story of the origin of Selected Shorts, I think, is a really great one. So in 1985, at Symphony Space, this space on the Upper West Side of New York, they were doing a marathon reading of Joyce for Bloomsday. And someone read a story from Dubliners, and one of the Selected Shorts founders, Kay Catarulla, turned to Isaiah Sheffer, who is one of the Symphony Space founders, and said, "Actors reading short stories on stage, what an idea, right?" And apocryphally, the response that Isaiah said was, "No one's going to come to that." So that's the origin of this thing that has become a phenomenon over the last 35 years. I believe, and I think that probably we all agree, feels like such an immense gift to people who are writing short stories, and such a gift to the field of short stories as they continue to be potentially endangered by the novel. I feel like that's the narrative that we're fed over and over again. But I know we have our fans out there in the space today. So So I wanted to start by asking each of you if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about your story and then just reading a paragraph from your entry in this book so that people can get an idea of the stories that are included. Luis, would you mind kicking us off?
Okay. I'm Luis Urrea. I come from a barrio in San Diego, Logan Heights. And it was hard scrabble. And I think my dad wasn't necessarily thrilled that my dream that, you know, was one of those, what are you going to do in college? And I said, I'm going to write poems, Dad. Muy Mexicano, you know. What? And he was forced to do menial jobs. And one of them, which was a transformative job, was as a bakery truck driver, Helms Bakery. And it, for me, you know, in the apartment block, it was magic because my dad would come home at 5 o'clock in the truck and it had a train whistle. Woot, woot. And then I'd accompany him to the garage. And every day he would go to the back and say, let's see what we've got. And he'd pull out a drawer and he'd say, ¿Qué tipo de donut, mijo? I'd say, chocolate a pan. He'd say, no, men eat glazed, right? And I would come back with stuff like, you told me Aztecs invented chocolate, Dad. So, and that's a memory that stuck with me. So when they asked me to write a story, I actually went too long, first of all, but they took it anyway. And I had had a good experience with them with another story. So, you know, one of the few really precious memories of those days. Turning to this. So in this story, the boy's mom is taken by immigration. And he's having a really hard time adjusting. And his father sees it and decides to take him on a bakery run in the truck. So it's just a little piece. I didn't know the world was so big. It had pretty much been the walk to and from school, our alley, and some car trips to stores like Kresge's down National Avenue, which we had been going to that day when we had the car crash that destroyed our Ford. Ma, who did take the bus, took me to the zoo one time, took me downtown, where we walked all day looking at the boats down on the harbor. One time, Pa took me to a bowling alley, and we went to the Big Sky Drive-In. But now we rolled down to National City and into Chula Vista, into Pinoy Town, all the way out to Lemon Grove. He had an AM radio in there, and it was all Phil Rizzuto yapping about sports. And the old redhead, Arthur Godfrey, mumbling with people about things I didn't care about. There was no way Pa was going to tune it to KCBQ radio because he was never going to allow the Beatles into his truck. Los Beatles, he said. In his transitional Spanish, he would say, ¿Qué tipo de hombres? What kind of men?
Thank you so much. And the context is so nice, too. One of the lovely things about this anthology is that there are contributor's notes for each of the stories, so you get a little bit of insight into each of the stories that are included, too. Juan?
Sure. I'm Juan Martinez. The story that I'm going to, that is in here, is called Cerati After Cerati. It was story about a Venezuelan Uber driver driving around Chicago, and it is also a ghost story. And the part that I'm going to read is the moment where he starts kind of realizing that he is inside a ghost story. But he doesn't quite get it till the end, because he's also busy driving in Chicago, and that takes a lot of concentration. Yes, and the story, I'll just read the paragraph. And then, also like Luis, I need reading glasses. But this is the year that I realized that I needed reading glasses. I just thought the quality of print all across every book ever had magically...
Everything was really bad.
It's like, I was like, oh, that's the supply chain, right? Like, yeah. The books get blurry. All right, so Cerati After Cerati. The protagonist is Gustavo. And the name of his Uber... customer is Patricia. He's dead, Patricia said. Gustavo didn't know if he believed her, The songs kept coming. Another solo song from an album that came out in 2014, the title A Joke, If Patricia Was Telling the Truth, Hora de Relajarse. They passed Dulcelandia, the Mexican party supply store. The window display lit up. Every piñata pressed against the window, ready to get out. They were close. The moment he dropped her off, there'd be someone else in wait, another stranger, another destination. He'd have to resurrect his imaginary son all over again. He would check about Cerati's death, though now he remembered his cousin talking about how strange Cerati's coma had been, how sad and unexpected, how even the Swedish band Roxette paid Cerati tribute. Roxette toured Chile in 2012 and covered the Música Ligera. Singers never quite died, the Swedes said. Their music lived on.
Thank you. Joe?
It's great to see everyone in a public space together, especially in this space. So thank you so much for showing up. We really appreciate it. And also, Jack Gems is much too humble and classy to admit that she has this phenomenal story in here as well, and you should definitely check it out. It's incredible. About 10 years ago, I had lost my friend Francesca in a bike accident off of Division and Western Avenue. And she was just this amazing, artistic, inventive person, played music. And a short time afterwards, I felt like I hit this point in listening to music and watching films and reading books where it felt like I had just lost that sense of discovery and kind of wonder that I think we're all searching for when you read a short story or watch a film or put on a song you've never heard before. And just that feeling that, oh, this is just another remake, or this is a book that's been kind of retold 100 times, or this music sounds like it's from the 80s. That feeling maybe of having lived long enough to recognize the pattern of everything, but still that sense of hope that you have that you'll find something new. So this story is a second-person story. So it's told in second person, and it's about a young woman who works at a bookstore over in Wicker Park, and that feeling of wanting to find something that gives you that sense of wonder again. So it's called Books You Read. Books you read last year were all bad. Are you getting older, or is the world just becoming less interesting? Books don't mean what they used to. You haven't found yourself enjoying one since 2012 when you read A Wrinkle in Time. You borrowed it from a girl you were babysitting and loved it so much you ended up stealing it, even though you know you're way too old. You're embarrassed how much you still love fantasy and YA. Something in your heart has stopped growing. You've become skinny now in all the wrong places. You work in a bookstore even though you don't enjoy reading. Nothing keeps you up late at night, turning page after page anymore. Even Murakami has become familiar. Your bookstore sells used books. You purposefully missort the authors you admire, hoping to keep them secret for as long as possible. When it's not busy, you magic marker out the best parts. The scene where Franny faints, or Beloved climbing up out of the water. Scout finding the hidden objects inside the tree.
Thank you. My first question is about your experiences with selected shorts, and if you've attended one of the readings of your work, if you've heard your work on the podcast, and if you can talk about that and what that experience was.
So I'll just real briefly, when I was in graduate school, I worked at this flower shop over on North Avenue, and it was probably the greatest job I ever had in my life. Like, everybody loves, well, not everybody, but almost everybody loves to see the flower delivery person, and only like once out of 10 times were you there to deliver flowers for like an apology. You know what I mean? But rest of the time, like, everyone loves seeing you and you're dropping off flowers. And every Saturday at 5 p.m., I'd be in the middle of, like, delivering flowers and selected shorts would come on. And I recall so specifically, like, being alone in this big van that was all banged up, full of flowers, and hearing these stories, you know, that were being performed by just these phenomenal actors, and just trying to, like, reconcile, like, what would it be like to have a story that's read by some amazing actor like that? And I think it was maybe about 10 or 15 years ago when Catherine from Selected Shorts reached out, and it felt like you had joined this incredibly exclusive club of not only writers you admired, but the actors as well. And the fact that Selected Shorts hasn't given up on the short story and sees it as valuable, as important as any other part of pop culture, it really means so much.
So I've been very, very lucky in that I've had that happen to me three times. I've been in Selected Shorts times, counting this one. And the first one just came out of the blue. It was very, very strange. The story was like super short, and it's about somebody who's speaking in deliberately a fake accent and then starts singing Don Quixote at one point. That's like it's a very goofy story. And then I went to the Getty Center because I was a grad student in Las Vegas, and I could go, we could drive, and I said, like, oh my God, this is awesome. Especially seeing like somebody like doing a story that I never in my wildest dreams would imagine anybody performing. And then I said, like, no writer should ever be reading their own work ever. It should just be professionals who know are really good at this. But the second time, it was a commissioned story. So I knew what I was in for. And this time I put in deliberately like six fake voices in the space of like two pages, because I was like, I'm just gonna make, they can do it. They can do whatever they want. It was the actor, Kristen Milioti, who's in Made for Love now. She's the actor in Made for Love. She was also the mom in How I Met Your Mom, I think. So I did that, and I was like, she did an amazing job. And I was like, yes. And then that story became the title story of my book. And I then realized that I would have to start reading that story out loud. And I just shot myself in the foot, because it's like, I can do my accent, and that's it. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I used to live in the Rockies, and I always thought I was going to be a Westerner. Certainly not a Chicagoan. Been here 21 years, I guess. I changed. But so I was hanging out with some old Glala guys, brothers, and I wanted to write a story to honor these guys. And one of them was named Mike Hermany Horses, which I thought was the best name I'd ever heard. So I wrote this story called Bid Farewell to Her Many Horses. And I had also read this article that talked about the favorite words of different cultures in literature. And it turns out that Americans we can't survive the beauty of the word home. That's our word. And so I was a jerk, really. I thought, I'm going to write a tearjerker and somehow end it with the word home. Let's see if it worked. And it got published in something. And then all of a sudden, Selected Shorts contacted me. And I thought, yeah, it worked. And they asked us to come. And my wife, Cindy, and I went to Symphony Space. And they were so kind. And Ted Marcoux, one of the Broadway actors, was reading it. And they were like, come backstage. And I was like, no, I am Mr. Humble. And we sat there to watch. And Ted, apparently, when he heard we were there, he ran all the way around the theater to us. And I thought, oh, my God, this is a big deal, you know? And he read it, and I was dumbstruck. And then they did it again with another actor a year later. So that was my experience. It was just an unexpected ray of light. And when they wrote and said, you know, you want to do a story for this, I said, yeah. I tried not to end it with the word home, though.
That's fantastic. Yeah, there was a time, my first experiences with Selected Shorts was, I was working at a software company and doing a lot of work that amounted to data entry, but it meant that I could just listen to podcasts all day, and I worked my way through all of the Selected Shorts recordings that I could, and I told my partner, I said, I could be perfectly happy for the rest of my life just doing this, I think. If it paid well enough, I feel like this could be it for me. Like, I'll just listen to short stories being read aloud. So, and then I remember that a former Chicagoan Betsy Crane, Elizabeth Crane. I remember seeing that she was having a story read on Selected Shorts, and my mind blew up. I was like, someone I know is having a story on Selected Shorts? This is unreal. This is like, you know, this is the pinnacle to me. So, so then when they reached out to me to ask to read one of my stories, I was like, how did you find me? I'm no one. The people whose stories you read are like these incredible, you know, iconic writers. Like, you want my little dumb story about board game night? Like, So it's just such an exciting thing that they do. And then once they start working with you, it seems like they really like keep that relationship up and like continue fostering that, those connections, which is such a rare thing, I think, sometimes, you know. Juan, I wanted to ask a follow-up question to Luis and Joe. One of my other questions had been, when you knew that your story for Selected Shorts was going to be read aloud, did you do anything different? And I love that you did, Juan. But Joe and Luis?
No, but possibly because I started out as a theater major. So I was just like, let's see you do your stuff, man, you know? And he was fantastic. So, you know, it wasn't what it would have sounded like if I'd read it. Yeah. But that's what was so great. You may have had this experience too, though, that you hear every kind of flub you left in or like, oh, man, are you kidding me? I wanted to stop and revise it one more time, you know?
Right. Well, that's what's so interesting, that even with a piece of short fiction, you're never done with it, right? And there is something about someone else reading it that gives it much closer kind of sense of finality than if you... I would be up there substituting words or like, oh, I didn't like... Why did I put that in there? Or jumping sentences. And so it gives you this great opportunity that you don't often have as a writer, which means you get to watch someone else take this work in and respond to it kind of in the moment. And, you know, what we do as writers, especially as short fiction, it's like you're just sending messages in a bottle out there and you're hoping it means something to somebody. But to watch someone kind of give it life in that way, it's really, really powerful. I had this story that Michael Ian Black, the comedian, read a couple years ago. And he's so dry, you know, and he just killed it. I knew if I read it, I would just be like, trying to lean into the laugh or whatever. And he was so dry. It was brilliant. And that's what, I don't know, I think to have that opportunity to see your work through someone else's eyes is such a gift.
You know, that's interesting because one of the things that was good for me to watch a Broadway guy, and because it was a Western story, he had jeans and cowboy boots on, you know. But I do a lot of, because my eyes have been so bad, I often just do the text from memory, because they're not following along.
Right.
I'm improvising jazz, you know, on my melody. But to hear him embody the voices was kind of liberating for me, because I thought, oh, stop being a ham bone, you know. You go to grad school and everybody reads in the poetry voice. Like, and here was this guy just, you know, giving life to these people. Yeah. And so in a way, that helped me find my voice to this day, you know, at least in performance.
Yeah, that was another one of my questions was, what was the experience of hearing your work read by someone else? Did you learn anything about your own work? I like the idea. I agree with the idea that you hear the flubs in someone else's voice, and you're like, oh, okay, that made sense to me, but it doesn't make sense when someone else is reading it. Or just the audience reaction, too, if there is a difference for you from when you read your work.
I think for me, one of the many things that has felt so difficult over the last 2 years is like writing something and then sharing it with an audience live. Like that's always been the way that I feel like something is done and I can like move on. And whether it's a short story or reading parts of a novel and not having that opportunity to like write something, put it out there and read it. It feels like a lot of the things I've worked on over the last couple of years are pretend or kind of make believe. And there's even just now, you know, being able to talk about these stories, there's something about the recognition that the audience completes the work or that turning it over to someone else's hands and saying like, okay, this is done, I'm ready to let this thing go, is really gratifying. Because otherwise, I feel like just the way, you know, I work as a writer, I would just keep, be happy to like, oh, that didn't do what I wanted to. I'm going to keep reworking it. And I think, yeah, having a famous act like Joan Allen, this incredible actor, read one of my stories, and I was like, there's not, what am I ever going to do? You know what I mean? Like, how am I going to read that story in a different way? That's the story. That's like the historic record now. I'm like, move on, start another story, never touch that one again. You know, like, that's retired. So it's a great feeling of kind of like finality that we don't often experience, I feel like.
I don't think I have too much to add to that. I feel that's been one of the like really great surprises of Selected Shorts. It also, like, for the one that that we saw, I realized that the story that I wrote for this this was actually, it's a one of these very Chicago stories that I've been writing. This story, I was obsessed with the Pulaski Corridor. And so, like, I remember just, like, writing down the name of every, like, Botanica and, like, every sort of, like, weird business that was just there, down there. And I had heard so much about Dulcelandia, like, the piñata store. And I had not realized that it's not just, like, oh, they sell piñatas. It's like, no, that you, these piñatas are coming at you. There's, like, just a bunch of piñatas. So, so the feeling of realizing, oh, this story is very Chicago. And then hearing it in New York felt good, but also it's not the same. It also felt like, oh, this is like a, had written it partly as a ghost story that was set in Chicago for Chicagoans, right. I guess. That was the, yeah. But I'm glad it's out there for other people, too. What about for you?
The first story that I had read by them, Jordan Klepper from The Daily Show read it. Yeah. And I didn't know the story was funny. Or, you know, like every time I read it, I maybe got a laugh or two. And people were laughing like every other line. And I was like, whoa, this is amazing. This is like what a good performer can do. Like what you were saying, that like writers should not be reading their work on their own, which is funny that that I asked all of you to read from your work. And that is not what the idea of Selected Shorts is. But I think you're all, I think you're all very strong performers in your own right. So that was really interesting to, and he read lines in ways that I hadn't heard them read in my mind, and so that was so interesting. But then another one of my stories, Lauren Ambrose read from 6 Feet Under and Can't Hardly Wait, if you're of that generation, she read it exactly as I'd imagined it, and that was also powerful in its own right, because it was like, okay, like I got it onto the page, like the thing that I had in my mind, the rhythms, all of it is there in the language to be found if you're paying attention. And that's just, it feels like, you know, it's just such an astounding thing to get to experience. So I you know, to kind of spin us out into the wider world of short stories, I'm wondering, you know, I know that all of us write short stories and write novels as well, and I'm wondering what the short story means to you and where you think it's going. What does it hold for you that that longer works don't?
Oh, yeah, you guys all look at me. All right. Dude, you know, I'm a 60s kid, so the short story is the 45, you know? And the novel is Tommy, you know? There's something, I love poetry too. Probably my first mania was sci-fi stories and then poems. All of a sudden when I found poems, I thought, what is this stuff? Not what they taught me in school. By the shores of Gichigumi, by the shining big sea waters. You know, I was like, what is this crap?
I memorized that whole poem in
10th
grade.
We had to
it's
do
like
it.
5 pages long.
Oh my God, we tried. So there's something to me so astonishing in a well-wrought story. And I have to be careful because I will just keep rambling and I write these too long novels. But to get to a moment, you know, that epiphanic moment that takes a turn and maybe makes a little space in the world is something that I can't get over, and I'm always trying to get there, you know? And then you realize that if you're doing it right, you might be able to construct a novel made out of about 100 little short stories if you can find the right connective tissue. It's just, it's so much fun. And I just want to say about the process here, when they did it again, they had a different actor. And I don't know if you remember that show House, but the guy who was House's long-suffering boss, I can't remember his name, hope he's not here, he was completely different from the first guy. And at first I thought, well, you're violating the text. And then then his version became the version. And I think I think about stories like A Worn Path by Eudora Welty, that every time you go to it, though it be small, it is fierce. And, you know, it's one of the best stories to teach in the way I teach, to just look at the facets. Look what she does with the sound units. Look what she does with the imagery. Look at, you know, and I always stop the grads and I say, is this a happy story in any way? She never says it's sad, but boy, it's overwhelming. That to me is brilliant work, to be able to condense a novel's worth of experience and feeling in that little nugget.
I was gonna answer that question like in a weird two-part kind of way, but I'm gonna keep it super, super short. I feel like one definite thing that I love about the short story has less to do as a writer than it does as a reader. My friend Alyssa made this point, which is that when you're like, I love how in Chicago, like if you're on the L, you're in the Metra, there's always people reading. Like it's like a city of readers, right? And what my friend Alyssa like pointed out, I've never been able to forget this after, is if you see somebody reading like a story collection, that's like hardcore. You know, that's a hardcore reader right there. That's somebody who really probably reads too much, right? Like that's the...
It's a cry for help.
Yeah, that's a... So that was one answer. My other favorite answer about that, though, is that I, as a writer, was primarily a short story writer, and then people were like, novelists, like people who like write 20 novels, say, oh, like, if you can write a short story, like a novel's like easy, blah, 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 and they were lying. Right. Like, that was just the biggest lie. If you hear this, don't believe people that like writing but when I finally finished like a draft of draft 17 of the novel, and I was like, I sat down, and then I had a story that was like pretty much locked in like in a week. And that had, and that's after like 4 years of working on a draft of a novel. So like it felt so good just to write and then go, oh, meh, done, right? So that move from like long to short and then from short to long does something really cool to your brain as a writer that I would urge people to try. Like if you're like, just how many people write in here? Because I know like audiences, okay, good. Like I'm seeing very shy hands, which is like a sign of a writer anyway, right? Like we're not going to raise it. Like I would like urge anybody, like if you've never tried going from long to short or from short to long, you should definitely do it before somebody tells you it's easy, but it's easy.
That means all of them are writers, because half of them went like this, yeah. and then the other half
I saw
just
them.
Like, I'm not, I'm, I want to be a writer, but
yeah. A writer.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, ever since like having kids, my daughter's in eighth grade now, my son's like 11, and this idea of imaginary spaces has become really important to me. This idea that like I get up at 6:15 and like from that point to the time I go to bed, like my day is just filled with being around other people and doing things, and there's something incredibly different about the imaginative space that a short story opens up in a very different way than when you're reading a novel over a couple days or weeks. You come back to it. And I think it forces you to be adaptable as a reader, not even as a writer, because you like immerse yourself in the lives of these characters for a couple pages and it's over. And I think it's like the perfect lesson, especially in the context of the last couple years of like immersing yourself fully in this moment and looking for that moment of wonder or change that happens, and then being ready, like, that's all you got, and you're moving on again. And so, like, just that rehearsal that kind of takes place, and the, I don't necessarily always have time to read a 400-page book the way I'd want to, and just giving myself time to, if I can read one short story, a 5-page short story, I mean, most of these stories in the book are 5-6 pages, it almost felt like taking a short lacuna break or like walk or like I just went into the woods for, you know what I mean? That feeling that I feel like over the course of the day, I need to have 30 minutes where I'm not doing anything except imagining something, and it's not productive in a way that's gonna I'm gonna use towards a job or towards my kids or wife or, you know what I mean? The sense that when you're a kid and you used to doodle in school just for fun because it was imagination and play, there's something in that in a short story that feels very different than when you're kind of going through a novel. And I just recognize, like, I need that to just stay present in my life.
Yeah, I feel like short stories, the economy of it is such a perfect, miniaturization of that feeling of waking up to the thing that's been around you all the time, but you haven't noticed it. You know, that's like, I feel like that's the thing that short stories really can do for me in such a quick, easy way is, you know, like you're given this thing and you're taught how to see it in this very, like, in this very contained little unit. And it's just, you know, and I mean, that's my favorite thing about being a writer on any scale, but the fact that that can happen in, you know, in a page sometimes or 10 pages or whatever, you know, is just such a miracle. I'm wondering, so you mentioned Eudora Welty's A Worn Path, and I'm wondering if you have, what your stories are, you know, what your stories are that that you return to or that, like, changed something for you, or I know we're all teachers, too, so if there's the story that is your perfect teachable story.
I have, like, a one story that is almost, like, not even a story, and it's not even teachable, but it's such, it feels like such an encapsulation of the writing process that I give it to my students, and it's not technically not even a story because then Kafka uses it as the preamble to the trial, but it's Before the Law, right? And if anybody, I'm not going to do it justice, but it's literally just somebody trying to get access to the law, and there's a gatekeeper, and the gatekeeper's saying you can't come in. And then it says, well, maybe I can try. And it says, well, if you try it, there's going to be somebody else way more powerful behind me who's going to stand in front of another door. And if you think I'm scary, you should wait till you get a hold. So the guy just waits there forever. And the way the story ends is, says, you know, I've never seen anybody try to walk through this door. And what the gatekeeper says, oh, yeah, no, this door was meant only for you. And I am going to shut it now. And that's the story. And then I tell them, like, it's our jobs as writers to just, like, maybe not listen to the gatekeeper and just keep walking, even when somebody tells you that you're not, because it's, you know, that's your door. There, nobody else is going to be walking through it. That's so it's not a teachable story.
That's great.
But it's, and just realize it's kind of like it's a terrible thing to tell, like, very young people. I just said, like, you know, but that's the thing that I give them, that I mean, I love Kafka in general, but that particular two-page thing always gets me.
Hey, I have two really short ones, and one is The School by Donald Bartlemy.
Me too.
And it's real quick. It's like 2.5 pages, and there's, I don't know, this feeling of like going to the circus or like going to a carnival where, like, how he moves, it's about this school where all the things in the school, these, like, pets.
Did you say his name? Donald Barthelme.
Yeah, Donald Barthelme.
Everybody keeps dying.
Everything keeps, like, the plants in the classroom die, the hamster dies, like, and then, but it gets, like, more and more serious and greater escalation as the story goes. And you can follow that, it almost feels mathematical. Mm. And then there's a point in the story where it just jumps the tracks entirely, and it's such an amazing feeling, and I think that's what I love about Donald Bartlemy's work so much, is he's like almost like an architect, and then there's a point where he's like, I just built this thing and now I'm going to leap off the top of it, and it's the most, it just feels kind of revelatory and transcendent, that feeling. And I think that's what I'm always searching for in a story, is like, what's the pattern and when does the pattern shift to something I didn't expect or, you know, I couldn't have planned. And the second one is this older story. I think it's from 1922, Katherine Ann Porter's The Grave.
Oh, yeah.
which is these two kids who are digging around in this graveyard where these coffins have been exhumed. And one, this brother and sister, and they're out hunting rabbits. And it's so quick. It's 3 pages. And it's a whole world, and you get their whole lives in these 3 pages. And I've read that story like hundreds of times, and I still don't know how she did this thing. And I think, Juan, this idea that like novels are more complex or more difficult, I believe the complete opposite. I think if you can do all of that in 3 pages and not 300, I think you're that great of an artist. So there's something about that story I just endlessly kind of return to, and it always feels like a discovery at the end.
That's awesome. I also have 2 stories. One of them, just because part of me's kind of punky, and nowadays everybody has to hate Hemingway, and so I want them to read Hills Like White Elephants to find that somebody can write a story never saying what the story's about, and you know to your heart, and you also know that he's sympathetic to the woman. He was more complex than we think.
Yeah.
Good old, good old homeboy.
All dialogue.
But the one I find myself going back to a lot, I've realized about myself as a writer that I am fascinated by the sense of sacredness. Not religion, but things are sacred, and they're sacred to different people. Things are, for want of a better word. And so for me, it's Sonny's Blues by Baldwin. When I first read that story, I honestly gasped and might have even wept, because I was like, how did you just do that? There's that moment that I won't go into, but it's incredible. So if you haven't read that, James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues is unbelievably moving and beautifully done. It's not sentimental. And then all of a sudden, it kind of is.
Yeah, just the final trembling. Yeah, the final page of that. It's musical. It feels symphonic. And yeah. And again, you're like, these are just words on a page. You have to like almost remind yourself, like, these are just words someone put down on a page. And you get so deeply wound into the lives of those two brothers. It's just incredible.
Sonny's Blues is Hannah Tinti, the editor of this anthology that we're all in. That's her touchstone, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's so beautiful. I think that I have a few, too. The School is one of my favorites because of the way that it just, because of that turn at the end. It's a very poetic move, right? It's the volta, basically. It's that structure and then surprise idea. And I feel like that's what most of my favorite short stories are able to do, and maybe that's why I like short stories so much, is it can have the movement of a poem rather than this thing that's just, you can take the structure of a poem and move it onto narrative, another story that works that way for me that I remember really just kind of blowing my mind wide open was Amy Hempel's The Harvest, where she tells this whole story and then she sort of interrupts herself and tells you all the things that she lied about in the story. And you have this sort of like layering of narrative and that sort of trick or way of kind of changing what you thought the story was about into something else at some point is such a exciting move to me. And there are so many different ways you can do it. I think that we might have time for a few questions from the audience, if anyone has any.
I wanted to ask about 3 stories. They're pretty old. They have whiskers, a matter of fact. But would they lend themselves to selected shorts? I'm thinking of Paul Theroux's White Lies. You might have read that. And then There Are No Snakes in Ireland by Frederick Forsyth. That's a great. And Black Mephisto by Harlan Ellison. I'd like to hear those at selected shorts, but I've never had a chance.
We'll put in a request. Who do we need to talk to?
That's the thing. I have no idea how stories get out, how they choose. They must just read so much all the time. I'm not involved in the selection of the stories on the, and I, Jennifer, I think it's Jennifer Brennan who ends up doing a lot of it, but she's featuring writers who don't even have story collections out yet. I had a story read at the Getty Center a couple months ago, and the person's book had just come out that week, and one of the stories was being read, and I was like, how did you find, you know, there's too many short stories, there's not too many short story collections, but there's so many more than I'm able to get to in my reading time, that the idea that that the organizers of this thing are also reading, must be reading literary magazines is so astounding that they're really paying that close of attention and thinking about how to cultivate up-and-coming voices as well as really well-established ones. But that's such a tough balance to find, and being able to really celebrate and keep in the awareness well-established voices that there's so many gems out there that have not gotten the star treatment the Selected Shorts gives to the stories, but then making sure that you're supporting new writers as well. Yeah. Okay. Then I hope that you will join me in a healthy round of applause for the panelists today.
Thanks so much, Jack.
Yeah.
Jack, thank you so much.
Fantastic.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, authors and editors Rebecca Mackay, Diva Markellis, and Lauren DeJulio Bell discuss their contributions to the collection Growing Up Chicago. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.